And since that's the main subject of my talk, I thought it might be interesting. And also, his book is instructive into why we're confused or suspicious about imagination. And I do want to talk about how modernity has displaced imagination and its rationale. The first chapter of the book is called The Old Myth and the New. How many of you know Tom Howard's work, by the way? Okay, so this will be new for most of you. Tom has he's a little affected sometimes, but we'll forgive him that. There were some ages in Western history that have occasionally been called dark. They were dark, it is said, because in them learning declined and progress paused and men labored under the pall of belief. A cause-effect relationship is frequently felt to exist between the pause and the belief. Men believed in things like the Last Judgment and fiery torment. They believed that demented people had devils in them and that disease was a plague from heaven. They believed that they had souls and that what they did in this life had some bearing on the way in which they would finally experience reality. They believed in portents and charms and talismans, and they believed that God was in heaven and Beelzebub in hell, and that the Holy Ghost had impregnated the Virgin Mary, and that the earth and sky were full of angelic and demonic conflict. Altogether, life was very weighty, and there was no telling what might lie behind things. The ages were, as I say, dark. Then the light came. It was the light that has lighted us men into a new age. Charms, angels, devils, plagues, and parthenogenesis have fled from the glare into the crannies of memory. In their place have come coal mining and E equals MC squared, and plastic, and group dynamics, and napalm, and urban renewal, and rapid transit. Men were freed from the fear of the Last Judgment. It was felt to be more bracing to face nothing than to face the tribunal. They were freed from worry about getting their souls into God's heaven by the discovery that they had no souls and that God had no heaven. They were freed from the terror of devils and plagues by the knowledge that the thing that was making them scream and foam was not an imp, but only their own inability to cope, and that the thing that was clawing out their entrails was not divine wrath, but only cancer. Altogether, life became much more livable, since it was clear that in fact nothing lay behind things. The age was called enlightened. The myth sovereign in the old age was that everything means everything. The myth sovereign in the new is that nothing means anything. That is, to the darkened mind, it did not mean nothing that the sun went down and night came and the moon and stars appeared and then dawn and the sun and morning again and another day which would itself wax and then wane into twilight and dusk and night. It did not mean nothing to them that the time of work was under the aegis of the bright sun, and that it was the sun that poured life into the seeds that they were planting, and that brought out the sweat on their foreheads, and that the time of rest was under the scepter of the silver moon. This was the diurnal exhibition of what was true, that there are a panoply and a rhythm and a cycle, a waxing and a waning, a rising and a setting, and then a rising again. And to them it was not for nothing that the king wore a crown of gold and that the Lord Mayor wore medallions. This was the political exhibition of what was, in fact, true. That there are royalty and authority and hierarchy at the heart of things, and that it is possible to see this in lions and eagles and queen bees, as well as in the court of the king. To them it was not for nothing that a man went into a woman in private and uncovered her and knew her and knew ecstasy in the experience of her being. This was simply a case in point of what was true anyway, that there is a mystery of being not to be thrown open to all, and that the right knowledge of another being is ecstatic, and that what appears under these carnal forms is in fact the image of what is actually true. The former mind in a world read vast significance into everything. Nature and politics and animals and sex, these were all exhibitions in their own way of the way things are. This mind fancied that everything meant everything and that it all rushed up finally to heaven. We have an idea of royalty, this mind said, which we observe in our politics and which we attribute to lions and eagles. And we have this idea because there is a great king at the top of things, and he has set things so that our fancies will be drawn toward his royal person, and we will recognize the hard realities of which the stuff of our world has been a poor shadow when we stumble into his royal court. So this mind handled all the data of experience as though they were images, cases in point, of each other and of the way things are. So that when they came across the idea, say, of the incarnation of the God, it made perfect sense to them, since it was in the nature of things to appear in images. Royalty in lions and kings, strength in bulls and heroes, industriousness in ants and beavers, delicacy in butterflies and fawns, terror in oceans and thunder, glory in roses and sunsets. So, of course, the God might appear in flesh and blood. How else? And when they heard about a thing like resurrection, they could believe it, since they thought they could see the same thing, life issuing from death, in other realms. Seed time and harvest, and morning and evening, and renunciation and reward. And so what else did it all mean but that it is the way things are that life triumphs over death? This mind saw things as images because it saw correspondences running in all directions among things. That is, the world was not a random tumble of things all appearing separately, jostling one another and struggling helter-skelter for a place in the sun. On the contrary, one thing signaled another. One thing was a case in point of another. And then later in this chapter, the faculty in us that establishes these correspondences among things, and hence allows us to see one thing as an image of another, is imagination. And the modern mind understands this to be a flight away from actuality. In this view, when primitive man spoke of the God of the wood, he was peopling an inanimate thing with projections of his own inclination to see things personalistically. Similarly, when the Bible speaks of the fear of the Lord as the beginning of wisdom, this was a helpful, although fanciful, way of personalizing reality, so that an accurate modern rephrasing would be, a sense of modesty and awe when confronted by the phenomena of experience is appropriate. When Dante fancies hell and purgatory and heaven as real states of being, he is, of course, projecting the human experience of alienation and discipline and bliss into a cosmic geography. When T.S. Eliot speaks of the journey of the Magi as a paradigm of human experience, we must remember that what the Magi found at Bethlehem was only an imaginary, that is, a fanciful thing, and that there is no scientific, that is, serious connection between this and anything real. Imagination, which is this faculty by which we suppose correspondences among things, and hence see them as images of one another, is understood in opposite ways by the old myth and the new. By the new, it is seen as a flight into fancy. By the old, it was seen precisely as a flight toward actuality. The new myth sees imagination as a flight into fancy, useful, to be sure, in helping us grasp rare abstractions like deity or ultimacy, or to articulate our experience of grief or love or beauty, but undoubtedly leading us astray to the extent that it makes us picture and personify things. After all, we know that mathematics and linguistic analysis and astrophysics are the disciplines under which we must describe our universe. And this whole mythopoeic way of speaking belongs to the ages that really believed that things were all animated and charged with identity and being, all dancing in the great dance. I wanted to start with that because of its imaginative expression of imagination, and because of the fact that he links so nicely the idea of correspondence, that imagination isn't about making things up, it's about recognizing things that are already there. And I want to talk in this talk about, particularly in poetry, the function of metaphor. But I think that to start with this articulation of the contrast between an older, a pre-modern, and a modern view is particularly helpful. A couple things to draw attention to in that passage also In the older view, there was a place for religion at the center of culture. That is not there any longer. And similarly, art or the work of the imagination is also marginalized. And it's fascinating to me that both that religion and the world of art, two spheres that are really fighting each other much in the modern world, have both been equally marginalized by modernity, and for very similar reasons. Religion is no longer an organizing principle for public life because it's assumed that religious claims are subjective, they're not about reality as it really is, and similarly, art is treated as a private diversion, not something that can really illumine reality out there. The arts are a nice frill when we can afford such things, but when an educational organization's budget is to be cut, well, we know that the budget for science or math is not as vulnerable as the funding for art education. When Congress considers new legislation or an executive branch department explores the possibility of new regulations, then they call in economists and psychologists and environmentalists, but poets and painters are not asked to testify on Capitol Hill any more than theologians are. Poets and painters aren't asked to provide an imagination impact statement, for instance. The arts remain public, but not an essential component of public life. Art also is too subjective and ethereal, and some might even say art is too spiritual to be regarded as necessary to public life. The arts are concerned with matters that transcend the material. They're too much like religion, in a way, to sustain a prominent place in the institutions that govern everyday life. Now, if you're a Christian artist, you suffer this dualism from two angles. Both art and religion are excluded from public life, but also art is excluded from the church very often. For many church leaders, the arts, far from being too spiritual, are too earthly and earthy to be coordinated with the ministry of the church. The ministry of the church is assumed to involve only the aspects of the inner life. Meanwhile, in the secular art world, religion is regarded with suspicion, and so artists are excluded and marginalized from the secular art world as well. One might have thought that religion and the arts could recognize one another as allies, as fellow refugees. But since they're both marginalized by the materialistic and pragmatic assumptions of modern culture. But it's helpful to remember that modernity is not just a movement toward rationality and away from alleged superstition, as Howard describes it. But modernity is also a movement dedicated deeply to the liberation of the individual self from all extraneous sources of authority, especially religiously based authority. And so art, meanwhile, particularly from the 19th century to the present, art has been very much in sync with the spirit of modernity, equally dedicated to the celebration of the autonomous self, and very suspicious of authority, especially religious authority. So modern art may not be very public, but its institutions are very modern and suspicious of religion. I have long wondered what would happen if Christians were known, if evangelical Christians were known in this country as those are the people who are always supporting increase in arts education, rather than those are the people also always supporting eliminating sex education. I mean, we could do both. Now, of course, arts education would have to be managed well, but the idea that cultivating the imagination would be a good public thing is something that I think we should champion. And I'm convinced that one of the reasons we don't perceive the glory of God that the heavens are proclaiming, and one reason that we don't perceive the things in creation that Paul suggests in Romans 1 that we should be able to perceive, is because we don't approach creation in the spirit of imagination. We don't approach creation with that assumption that there are likenesses and correspondence that are possible and that actually give us real information. I ran across a poem part of a poem several years ago when I was rereading an essay by Dana Gioia, who is currently the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts and a poet. And he was quoting in this essay a work by William Carlos Williams, who wrote late in his life, I think, a rather extensive poem, Asphodel, That Greeny Flower. And he comments in here about the widespread public indifference to art, particularly to poetry. My heart rouses, thinking to bring you news of something that concerns you and concerns many men. Look at what passes for the new. You will not find it there, but in despised poems. It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. In this grand generalization, Williams affirms that poetry is more vital, more life-giving than journalism. Who could imagine? At any given moment, millions of people around the world are watching CNN or Fox News or one of its clones, and when they see the caption superimposed on the screen proclaiming that something is live, they have a certain sense that what they are assuming is vital in some way. By virtue of its newness, its immediacy, its spontaneity, it is more important than something that's old or something deliberate or something carefully crafted. It's live. This is happening right now. It may just be a helicopter watching a car in traffic. Or it may be an empty podium in a government office with a grand seal on the front of it. But it's live anyway. We have some sense that maybe it's giving us life, perhaps. And I think we hold this assumption that the new and the unrehearsed are more honest and authentic than the old and the thoughtfully constructed, because we assume that all deliberate communication is an attempt to manipulate us rather than a gift that might reveal something. Williams suggests that, on the contrary, there is matter of universal concern in poems, which are, as he says, despised and rejected. Poems contain no news, but they can convey something urgently needed by those who are dying and miserable. As I say, I stumbled across this in reading this essay, first published in the Atlantic Monthly in 1991 by Dana Gioia. He's now chairman of the National Endowment since 2003, and his views about the state of the arts have a lot more weight than they did when he was a part-time poet and critic. He was then working full-time at General Foods, managing the Jell-O account when he wrote this poem. In fact, he wrote this essay, a lot of his colleagues didn't know he was a published poet, and he told me, I interviewed him a few times, he said, all these people came into his office right after this article appeared, and, hey, you're a poet, huh? And they'd quote something from Longfellow or something that they'd learned from high school. He said he went through this all the time. Gioia's essay lamented the fact that the audience for poetry had become small and insulated subculture in America. He was not so much concerned by the fact that there were fewer poets or fewer settings for poetry to be heard, but in fact that poetry had become a hyper-specialized special interest. Serious novelists are more likely to be visible in public than are serious poets. As he wrote, a reader familiar with the novels of Joyce Carol Oates, John Updike, or John Barth may not even recognize the names of Gwendolyn Brooks, Gary Snyder, or W.D. Snodgrass. Daily newspapers no longer review poetry. Harper's and the Atlantic Monthly once had quarterly reviews of new poetry. They haven't for decades. The attention to poetry in the New Yorker has declined, and beginning in 1984, the National Book Awards dropped poetry as a category. Poetry matters mostly to poets and would-be poets. Now, I think that that's part of a larger problem whereby cultural life has been transformed from something perceived as a legacy that we inherit, something that commands a certain kind of authority and evokes a sense of responsibility, of care and upkeep, to culture considered as an autonomously chosen commodity. Poetry is not now regarded as a part of our shared life, though it may be part of some lifestyles. We've entered an age not of multiculturalism, but of autoculturalism, where we are all invited to pursue, with apologies to the U.S. Army, a culture of one. It wasn't always the case that poetry was regarded as an esoteric and marginal pursuit. even in the U.S., from Longfellow to Whitman to Poe to Edgar Lee Masters to Robert Frost to Carl Sandburg to Archibald MacLeish, there have been American poets with much more expansive reputations than any poet can claim today. When I interviewed Joya recently on another subject, and he pointed out how he remembers as a kid growing up in a working-class neighborhood in L.A., watching The Tonight Show and seeing Robert Frost talk to Johnny Carson. I don't think poets show up on The Tonight Show today. At the very least, poetry had a more central place in the lives of people who had gone to college. And that was Joya's principal concern in that essay, that poetry doesn't matter to educated people. People who consider themselves to be well-informed, perhaps even self-consciously, culturally knowledgeable, poetry is not as great a concern as fiction or film or popular music. And he thought this was a public problem. Poetry, he writes, is the art of using words charged with their utmost meaning. Poetry at its best is the form, excuse me, this is a move from the quote from Joya. Richard Wilbur, another one of our greatest English-speaking poets, I think, similarly commented once that poetry at its best is the form of writing in which we talk with all of ourselves and employ all of our ways of knowing. Joya cited admonitions of Ezra Pound and George Orwell and others warning that a society whose intellectual leaders lack the skill to shape, appreciate, and understand the power of language will become more susceptible to political chaos. Joya also noted that the audience for other forms of serious art, including drama, classical music, and jazz, were also shrinking into private subcultures. Art forms that require attentiveness, forms that require foreground attention, and which may only be appreciated deeply after some sort of apprenticeship, seem to have less and less place in the lives of educated Americans. The idea that we have to train our imaginations, I'll talk about that in a minute, is an affront to many Americans. And the idea that you would have to grow to learn to love something seems unnatural. Poetry in particular lacks the public presence it once had, and I think that can be sensed not only in the absence of book reviews, but by the fact that the people who do speak in public most are journalists and our celebrities and our politicians, and maybe sometimes even our preachers, often speak as if they've never read or heard any poetry. Several years ago, our poet laureate was Ted Kooser. He also won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry, I think, the year before he was appointed. I want to read one of his poems called Selecting a Reader. First, I would have her be beautiful and walking carefully up on my poetry at the loneliest moment of an afternoon, her hair still damp at the neck from washing it. She would be wearing a raincoat, an old one, dirty from not having money enough for the cleaners. She will take out her glasses, and there in the bookstore, she will thumb over my poems, then put the book back upon its shelf. She will say to herself, "For that kind of money, I can get my raincoat cleaned." And she will. Ted Kooser's self-deprecating wryness at first seems to announce that poetry is impractical, that it can safely be ignored. But as it happens, Kooser's own poems are chock full of common sense and down-to-earth wisdom, so maybe this beautiful reader was brought to her senses by reading his poems, woke from her careless oblivion to the needs of her embodied life, and having acquired this practical knowledge of the world from a free read in a bookstore, declined to own the book. She owned knowledge that was in the poem. She needed a clean coat more on her body than she needed a new book on the shelf. And so Kooser's last three syllables, "and she will," has a sense of triumph about it. Triumph, Ted Kooser, the chivalrous poet hero who's delivered this beautiful maiden from her squalid captivity. Well, maybe that's what it means. I often wonder whether, I'm assuming that poetry matters as little to most evangelical Christians as it does to the population at large, which I think is an odd thing. If the world is indifferent to the word made most thoroughly articulate and evocative, why should the church mimic the world's indifference? There are churches that recognize Mother's Day, the 4th of July, even Super Bowl Sunday. They don't honor National Poetry Month, which would seem to have a more compelling claim on our attention than some of those other holidays, particularly because of the fact that poetry is a gift that is honored by example in the scriptures and in 2,000 years of the church's liturgical and devotional life. Poetry might matter less to Christians than to the population at large. I'd be heartened to hear that I was wrong. At an arts conference in 2003 at Seattle Pacific University, Dana Gioia offered some reflections on why the decline of interest in and the interest in more demanding forms of art should be felt as a troubling and often, and he offered a reason more profound than the threat of political chaos, as he suggested in that article. He writes, art is a distinct and irreplaceable way of knowing the world because it alone, unlike science or philosophy, uses and engages the fullness of our humanity. Art simultaneously addresses our intellect, our senses, our emotions, our imagination, our intuition, our memory, and our physical body, not separately, but together, simultaneously, holistically. If Dana Gioia's claim is correct, then art presents an opportunity to avoid the reductionistic and fragmenting tendencies of the culture that we live in, which assumes that science is the only proper way to know the world. Rather than analyzing and reducing to its component parts, poetry synthesizes, it recognizes likenesses and relatedness in the world, those elusive and connecting aspects of creation, knowledge of which is essential for the pursuit of wisdom. One of the hallmarks of modern society is the assumption that the only way to acquire real knowledge about reality, knowledge that can claim to be true, is through scientific techniques of observation and analysis. And this is what Howard was lamenting in that reading I offered early. That assumption has been the source of great cultural disorder in the modern world. It's one of the reasons why all claims about value, including ethical claims, as well as aesthetic claims, are now considered to be expressions of mere private preference. If you can't prove that something is good scientifically, then you can't make that claim in public. That's a private preference. I wonder whether Christians could nudge our society away from its moral relativism through urging a greater attention to imagination, and particularly to the fact that imagination is performing an objective work. It's helping us to understand something that's really true in the nature of things. As I say, it would be interesting to see Christians making headlines because of their entrenched commitment to the arts, to teaching poetry, rather than their opposition to teaching Darwin. Again, not saying it's either or, but it's a shame that we're only known for what we oppose and not what we affirm. Of course, I'm presupposing that Christians would affirm such a thing. Throughout his writing, whether in his literary criticism or his poetry or his fiction or his apologetics, C.S. Lewis assumed and insisted that poetic language really was a real medium of of truth. Not all of the knowledge received by the imagination was true, any more than all knowledge presented to reasoning faculties are true. But the imagination connected us to reality as truly as does reason. The way poetic expression conveys knowledge has resonances with what happens in contemplation, actually. Poetry, like contemplation, requires a kind of receptivity and openness to attend and to respond. There's an essay by John Cardinal Newman, in which he made the connection between poetry and contemplation, an essay he was writing about the Benedictine order. He contrasted a scientific way of knowing with a poetic way of knowing. And here, by poetic way of knowing, he's not just talking about poetry, but about what we might call imagination. Reason Newman writes, investigates, analyzes, numbers, weighs, measures, ascertains, locates the objects of contemplation, and thus gains a scientific knowledge of them. Science results in a system which is a complex unity. Poetry delights in the indefinite and the various as contrasted with unity, and in the simple as contrasted with systems. The aim of science is to get a hold of things, to grasp them, to handle them, to comprehend them, that is, to master them. Poetry demands, as its primary condition, that we should not put ourselves above the objects in which it resides, but at their feet. Poetry does not address the reason, but the imagination and the affections. It leads to admiration, enthusiasm, devotion, and love. Poetic knowledge, in other words, invites the engagement of the knower with the known. Poetic knowledge calls us away from detachment and dominion toward love and communion. Where the ideal of enlightenment knowledge is to get above reality in order to control it, the ideal of poetic knowledge refuses to deny our participation in the world. Poetry as a way of knowing challenges our glib assumptions about what we commonly call objective knowledge and subjective knowledge. As children of the Enlightenment, we assume that knowledge achieved through detached means is reliable, factual, true. Whereas knowledge that involves us in any way beyond pure analytic reason is subjective, which means arbitrary and idiosyncratic and private. And yet Augustine insisted that unless you believe, you will not understand. That is, you approach the challenge of knowing the world and of knowing God from the standpoint of belief. The modern mentality insists that belief and knowledge are enemies. If you believe, you will not understand. The knowledge that we acquire through poetic engagement with the world requires that we be committed subjects. As James Taylor, who's written a lot on education, has written, truth that is subjective is truth that one has made one's own. The observer is now engaged in the thing through co-natural knowledge, and one has, through sympathy, participated in the reality of the experience, so that knowledge ceases to be mere information and becomes existential and recalled as real. Poetic experience leading to poetic knowledge is concerned with bringing men into engagement with what is true. What is important is engagement with reality, not simply the discerning of reality. It's helpful to remember the two words rational and intellectual, derived from Latin roots ratio and intellectus, have traditionally been distinguished as lower and higher modes of knowledge. Rational knowledge is knowledge that has similarity with mathematical processes like ratios and addition and logical syllogisms. But intellectual knowledge historically was understood to include human imagination and intuition, the capacity to be engaged with reality more directly and more solidly than the abstraction of analytic knowledge. C.S. Lewis commented on this distinction in one of his essays. He says, I am a rationalist. For me, reason is the natural organ of truth, but imagination is the organ of meaning. And then he observed, imagination is not the cause of truth, but its condition. What he means by that is imagination helps us understand whether something is nonsense or sensible. It doesn't declare whether or not something is true, but we apprehend whether or not something makes any kind of sense before we make any kind of judgment about its truth claims through our imagination. Lewis believed just as one can reason carelessly or fallaciously, so the imagination was capable of being twisted and out of sync. So he believed that just as young people needed to learn to avoid formal fallacies or informal fallacies in logic, just as in pursuing a virtuous character they need to love what is good and just and despise that which is evil and unjust, so the imagination, the organ of meaning, required a kind of calibration. There's a book written back in the 80s by Robert Houston Smith called Patches of God Light, which looked at Lewis's thought. And Smith argues in there that Lewis was eager to rescue the imagination from being something relegated to just private experience and to restore it to a position of honor. Smith writes, Lewis was concerned to dispel the popular notion that whatever is imaginative is by its very nature false or non-existent. What the ordinary person fails to conceive is that there are some aspects of reality that can be conveyed in no other way than imaginatively. Inasmuch as reality itself transcends the most abstract language, the imagination can offer, when properly focused, higher levels, helping to lead the receptive mind toward a supra-verbal apprehension of reality that draws on the mind's capabilities of recognizing reality when presented with it. Thus, by imagination, Lewis meant something far more important than the aesthetic experience of the fabrication of fantasies. In other words, reality is knowable, but it's often ineffable. We can't reduce to words. Not because reality is too vague, but because our language is not dimensional enough. The dream of the Enlightenment was to translate all knowledge of things into a mode of expression that had a mathematical precision. And because sense perceptions were inexact and qualitative rather than quantitative, sense perceptions contaminated the search for knowledge and had to be dispensed with. And so all of the metaphoric and symbolic nuances of poetic expression, all the appeals to the imagination through the senses, were eliminated in the quest for certainty and the power that comes with it. Remember that quote from Dana Gioia: art is a distinct and irreplaceable way of knowing the world because it alone, unlike science or philosophy, uses and engages the fullness of our humanity. The philosophers of the Enlightenment, whose legacy is still very much with us, despite the claims that we're postmodern, those philosophers really didn't want the fullness of our humanity to be engaged in knowing the world. Specifically, they didn't want our bodies to play a significant role. The Enlightenment ideal of knowledge was profoundly Gnostic. It severed the human knower from the world of the senses and hence the world of imagination, which relies on metaphors fed by the senses. And we'll look at some biblical examples of that, particularly from the Psalms, in a few minutes. Colin Gunton, a theologian, has summarized this dualism that emerges in modern thought. It was assumed that there were two different kinds of reality. On one side of the line, he writes, was the material world, which was the object of the senses and the realm of impermanence and unreliability. On the other side was the intelligible world. That was what's understood by thought and accordingly the realm of permanence and reliability. That's an idea that starts to emerge in a systematic way in the work of Galileo and later by Descartes, became the orthodoxy of science. It was known as the two-substance theory. So the material world was really not a reliable source of knowledge. Mind was the world of abstractions, and so all the qualities that had formerly, in the words of Franklin Baumer, kept nature close to man, the fragrance of flowers, the songs of birds, the color and everything, all of these things were expelled from the world of rationality. And the result of this two-substance theory, nature came to be seen like a great machine or clock made of dead matter, possessing fundamentally mathematical characteristics, functioning mechanistically rather than purposefully. And we have grown up with that legacy of these two spheres of experience, separating the natural world, the world of the senses, the world of nature, from the human world. In a sense, our world is assumed to be the world of mind, the world of intellect. Now, art was still possible in such a world, and Northrop Frye, the literary critic, attempts to define imagination as a way to bridge these two worlds, which really didn't belong together. Imagination was a way of expressing a temporary and imaginary link between the world of the senses and the world of the mind, of humanity experiences mind. Frye suggests that the joy we experience in art is a delight at having overcome, for a moment, the alienation of the human world from the world of nature where our bodies dwell. But finally, he suggests that the bridging of the gap is illusory. The knowledge that's conveyed by the imagination, which suggests a continuity between the inner world of the intellect and the natural world, is just an imaginary thing. It's an illusion. Now, again, the account of creation that's implied in that modern view, that that our knowledge acquired through the senses does not give us a true knowledge. That's very much at odds with the Christian account of creation. Colin Gunton, a theologian whose scholarship focused on the doctrine of creation, insisted that all of the passages in Scripture that tie the person of Christ to creation have an important significance in restoring the validity of an imaginative way of knowing. Gunton wrote, "A world that owes its origin to a God who makes it with direct reference to one who was to become incarnate, part of that world, is a world that is a proper place for human beings to use their senses, minds, and imaginations, and to expect that they will not be wholly deceived in doing so." In other words, we're not merely created in the image of the God who made all things by his word. We're created in the image of the one who became flesh, who entered his own creation and talked about it from the inside. That's why the incarnation is so important to a Christian understanding of imagination. The incarnation doesn't just set an example for our making of concrete forms. The incarnation also establishes a continuity between us and God and the world that we inhabit. And it's on the basis of that continuity that both reason and imagination can properly and confidently take up with the world, and that the knowledge we acquire about the world need not be pure geometry to be valid. The work of Christ not only reverses our alienation from God, it reassures us that at the deepest level of our being, we are not alienated from the world. The Enlightenment ideal of analytic and detached knowledge produced a severe sense of alienation from creation. But if Christians read their whole Bible, they know that this alienating account misrepresents our nature and the nature of creation. It's out of keeping with the biblical account of the kind of creatures we are and the kind of world that God has placed us in. As Gunton puts it, we stand neither God-like over the material world, as the rationalists of the Enlightenment had encouraged us to think, nor at the mercy of something utterly different and incomprehensible, as existentialism reaction to rationalism may suggest. We can know the world, though not infallibly, not with an aim at a kind of omniscience, because we are both part of it and able to transcend it through our personal powers of perception, imagination, and reason. And perception, imagination, and reason come together perhaps most intensely in imaginative or poetic modes of knowledge and expression. Now, the Bible offers not just this theological foundation on which we can build a rich account of the reliability of reason and imagination. It also offers examples of how we can talk about God and ourselves and the world that employ all of those faculties that Dana Gioia talks about. Now, here's Psalm 19, which I think was one of C.S. Lewis's favorite psalms. It may have been his favorite psalm. From verse 7, "The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The rules of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold, sweeter also than honey and drippings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is your servant warned. In keeping them, there is great reward." This is a rich summary of how we should both think and feel and act in light of God's revelation, and it employs both abstract claims and imaginative claims. Like many of the Psalms, the passage presents an ideal image of how our souls ought to be ordered, how our affections and desires ought to be arranged. It is objective truth about a subjective condition toward which God's people should aspire, expressed in terms that employ both sensory knowledge and emotional appeals, as well as truth claims. To say that God's rules are sweeter than honey is a statement that requires imagination to apprehend as well as to obey. Since I think that declaration, God's rules are sweeter than honey, there's an implicit command there. That is, if you find God's rules bitter rather than sweet, then you need to strive to reconfigure your desires. The psalmist assumes that there's a reliable likeness, a correspondence in Tom Howard's terms, between a quality of something we can taste, something that happens in our mouth, and something to which we give assent and obedience. Remember the centrality of metaphor in the life of imagination. When C.S. Lewis explains imagination, he says, imagination producing new metaphors or reviving old is not the cause of truth, but its condition. Imagination is the condition of truth because it means that we can't understand or affirm the truth of a statement until we've apprehended the point of the metaphor. We can't affirm with the psalmist that God's rules are desirable and like gold or sweet like honey unless we understand the metaphor. And our imagination is, we can't affirm the truth of it unless we understand the metaphor. Our imagination is the organ whereby we can understand what sense it's making. That apprehension is what imagination does. Lewis is saying that imagination is the recognition of a likeness that God has created. Yesterday in my talk, I said that when Psalm 1 compares a righteous man to a tree, the psalm is not asserting an arbitrary likeness between trees and godly people, but in fact affirming something that's in the nature of things, a correspondence as part of creation. And the way of Christian obedience requires that we, too, imaginatively recognize those likenesses. One of my favorite biblical passages that testifies to the metaphorical structure of creation is at the end of 1 Kings chapter 4. Metaphysical structure of creation. I have a bumper sticker that says poetry happens. Someone had it made for me because I've been saying this a lot. These likenesses are in creation. 1 Kings 4, we read about the wisdom of Solomon, and it's a fascinating passage, kind of shocking passage in a way, beginning at verse 29. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore, little metaphor there, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all other men, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite and Heman, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. Here it sounds a little bit like a resume. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. This is his list of publications. The next verse gives us a sense of the content of Solomon's wisdom. I would not have predicted this verse. I would not have predicted a summary of this content expressing these things. If you'd ask most people, most pastors, most faithful Bible readers, what did Solomon write about? What kinds of things did Solomon comment on? What were his wise sayings about? This is not the list that we would have created. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and of birds and of reptiles and of fish. And people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. This doesn't sound very religious. It sounds like a National Geographic special or something. There's some remarkable assumptions in this passage, which really counter modern assumptions about knowledge and about creation. First, Solomon's wisdom is expressed in poetic form. He spoke 3,000 proverbs and his songs were 1,005. He didn't give abstract theories or utilitarian bullet-pointed tips for living. Wisdom, like life, has more in common with counterpoint than with PowerPoint. Second, Solomon's wisdom concerned an order that he perceived in creation. The source of Solomon's wisdom, wisdom that was applicable in many areas of life, was reflection on the things that God has made. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but its trajectory takes wisdom through regions shaped by the givenness of creation. And this passage ends with a testimony to the universality of Solomon's wisdom, demonstrating that his insights weren't just a reflection of provincial Israelite culture. People of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. He knew something about reality by his reflection on creation and his imaginative expression of that. What's presupposed in this passage is a coherence between the moral order and the natural world, a coherence that's so thick that the wisest man who ever lived relied on that coherence to fuel his own imagination. Solomon's songs about cedars and fish were imaginative expressions of what he perceived in that which God had made. I want to bring this up to the present in closing. From 1922 to 1925, there was a small literary magazine of poetry and criticism published at Vanderbilt University called The Fugitive, and some of the poets whose work appeared in there included Robert Penn Warren, Alan Tate, and John Crow Ransom, and their poetry and their criticism were highly influential in American literary scene at the time. They were profoundly concerned with formal and aesthetic issues, but they were also deeply concerned about social and cultural trends in modern culture. And many years later, Richard Weaver, a very appreciative student of theirs, commented on the fact how interesting it was that these critics of the mechanized, industrialized, technology-centered aspects of modern society were poets. And he wrote this: "It tells us a great deal about a man to know that he chooses as his form of expression the poetic medium. It tells us, I think, something about his system of ontology, that is something about his understanding of the nature of things. The entire corpus of the world's poetry rests upon a theory of universal analogy, which teaches that all phenomena in some degree resemble each other." It's exactly what Tom Howard was saying earlier. "The poet likens life now to a prosperous sea voyage, now to the sear and yellow leaf. These do not end with mere description. They place the subject somewhere on the ladder of universal analogy so that we gain an insight into the relationship to true being. Metaphor, the distinguishing gift of the poet, is the bridge between the phenomenal and the noumenal world, and it's no accident that there hangs about the poet, despite his often checkered mundane career, a certain aura of consecration. The practice of poetry amounts in effect to a confession of faith in imminent reality, which is the gravest of all commitments. Poetry works, in other words, because the world is a creation. It's not simply a meaningless cosmic accident. Metaphors are more than simply conventional. They have power because they reveal something about likenesses that God has placed in creation, or likenesses between the maker and that which he has made." This idea that poetry implies an affirmation of creation came up in an interview I did a number of years ago with Richard Wilbur, who I mentioned before, who I think is one of our greatest living poets. And Wilbur said in that interview, "The centrality of metaphor in poetry, quote, puts almost every poet in danger of being religious. If anything may be compared to anything else, if the world can be seen as a linkage of similes and metaphors and figures, then poetry itself comes very close to declaring that all things are co-natural, that is, that they are all of one nature, that is, they're all from a creator." And he went on, "And that brings you to the threshold of saying that all things have had a maker. I remember ages ago reading the final book of poems by Joseph Warren Beach, who claimed to be an atheist. And I took it around to him. He was in Cambridge at that time. And I said, 'Joseph, look at these two lines. Don't you think that they amount to a religious affirmation?' And he read them and said, 'Well, I can see that they do.' I must say I seem simply to have submitted to the spirit of poetry at that moment." It is an awesome thing to submit to the spirit of poetry, even for a moment. In closing, I want to comment on an observation made in a recent book by Eugene Peterson, a book called Christ Plays in 10,000 Places, a title he takes from a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins. "It is the task of the Christian community to give witness and guidance in the living of life in a culture that is relentless in reducing, constricting, and enervating life. The church," Peterson is saying, "in its ministry of discipleship and mission, must look at ways in which the culture around it has misshaped or misunderstood how to live life well in God's creation. And the church, in its teaching and discipling of its members, must encourage convictions and practices that are necessary to restore wholeness to life. And motivated by the need to love our neighbors, to care for widows and orphans in their misery, and having demonstrated to the world the ways in which redeemed humanity is fulfilled humanity, the church can then identify the false gods under whose captivity people are suffering. False gods can be philosophies and ideologies, and in our day, one of the most potent idols is the scientistic worldview that eliminates meaning from creation. The gospel is a message of salvation inside a larger story of all of creation, and it's a story that affirms both the goodness and the givenness of that creation. And it's on that foundational belief that the most imaginative art can be made or enjoyed. The lives of Christ's disciples should reflect the confidence of our convictions about creation. As I suggested yesterday, Christians are better known for fighting about the fact of creation than delighting in the glorious order of creation. But the Great Commission calls the church to make disciples who are eager to obey a Lord with a cosmic authority, a Lord who is both maker and brother. To avoid conformity to the spirit of the age, the church should attend to the renewing of minds, not just in rational activity, but also the renewing of imaginative obedience. We have the best case there can be for a lively and vital imagination. We have the story of creation and incarnation and resurrection. Love of our Lord and of our neighbor should compel us to establish and sustain all of the many ramifications of that wonderful story. Thank you.